Hello, everybody, and welcome to Food Conversations, a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. And we're delighted to have, as a guest today, Tessa Wetherill, who officially now is the land match coordinator for this area on behalf of Young Agrarians, but who has had a very interesting path to get to this point. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Tessa.
Good morning, Warren. It's great to be here.
It's terrific to see you. Everybody should know that, as usual, we're doing this on Zoom, so Tessa can sit in the comfort of her home with her feet right next to the heater, and we can sit here in the studio have a nice chat as if we were in the same room. So today we're going to talk, as I said, about your trajectory coming to be the point person for Young Agrarians in this part of the world, because as has been the rule pretty much with everyone who's come on the show, the way people get involved in this kind of work isn't just accidental, nor is it planned. It's a mixture of both, a little serendipity and a little bit of choice all mixed together, and it means you get to a place where your heart is really lodged in the work you do. So we'll go back to the very beginning. You were born and raised in the Okanagan, Tessa. Is that true? Am I telling the truth?
Yes, you are.
And your grandparents were farmers. And that simple fact actually played an important role in your early years. The farm was a special place for you. Tell us about that.
Yes, certainly. So I have such fond memories of spending time on my grandparents' orchard, running through the trees, and there was just such a sense of freedom there. Really captured me in a way that not much else did when I was that age. And I think those seeds were sort of laying dormant for a long time until I found my way towards becoming a farmer myself.
That's a perfect analogy. Seeds laying dormant. My goodness, you're immersed in the world of food. Your mother's family was Ukrainian. And speaking of food, that was an important issue for her and for the family as a result.
Yeah, food has always been a strong love language in my family. So that's the way that you show that you love somebody is you cook for them. It takes a long, long time, and you put all of your love into every carefully, meticulously rolled cabbage roll, and then you make sure that they eat until they can't walk.
Tessa, I have a vision of your family right now, and it's a very unusual vision. A lot of people unable to move because they've eaten so much. But obviously that meant that food, even though, you know, the food was, not elaborate food, but it was the attention, the care, and the love that went into preparing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the quality.
Yes. Yeah, did your parents try to buy food specifically thinking of quality? Was that sort of something that you were aware of when you were growing up? Or is that something that came later?
No, I didn't really have a sense of that. It was mostly about flavor, what tasted good. We knew that the cucumbers from the farm were tastier.
which is true. So your parents were also part of an intentional community, and as a result, you were homeschooled, which is an experience that many young people are having these days. And that also created a certain atmosphere in your life, friends as part of the community. Talk about that a little bit, that kind of lively atmosphere and people working together.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a unique situation. It was a religious community, and many people got together to live in a different way. And there were common values and lots and lots of kids around all the time. And it was also...
You saw people working together.
Certainly, yeah.
And that had an impact on you, seeing this kind of people helping each other and making burdens lighter?
Yeah, I saw what was possible when there was a larger value system than just trying to get yourself ahead. So there was a sense that we were all moving together in the same direction, that, you know, big tasks like, you know, putting an addition on so we could have another 5 bedrooms for another family to move in, you know, suddenly there would be 15 men pouring concrete and it would happen quickly, and that type of thing where there was just energy moving in a direction. And
it is a lesson for our time that we need to work together. So around when you were around 14, that's when the community kind of disbanded and you went to the regular high school. What was that like?
It was a shock, Warren.
Culture shock.
Yeah, certainly was. Yeah, I mean, 14 is a tough age regardless. But there I was with not many of the same sort of cultural reference points as a lot of the other kids. And that was challenging in some ways. But, you know, ultimately, I feel really grateful for the way that I grew up and for even for those challenging transition years, because I learned a lot.
The emphasis in schools, in the public schools, is often getting along with your fellow students. Whereas when you were in your community before that, there was no sense of having to make a big adjustment to what they were doing or thinking or believing. That must have been one of the difficulties that you had to deal with, this sort of different way of looking at the world, as it were, without those overriding values.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as you got out of school, you took off like a rocket.
I did.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I wanted to get away from everything. I wanted to get far away. So I went to Montreal, a place that I associated with, you know, glamour and European type, you know, bohemian lifestyle. And I went to art school and had a great time and learned a lot about myself in that process. And yeah, that's what I did.
How did it feel to be, as it were, released from this kind of social straitjacket that high school had been for you? It seems like a bit of a return to some of the feelings that you had when you were in the community with your family, but in a very different way, sort of freedom, but different kind of freedom.
Yeah, it's an ability to express yourself in whatever way you choose. So, you know, art school is the perfect environment for that, because there's a whole structure around doing whatever wild idea you want to do. So, you know, you want to hang wax bowls and light the street on fire and have somebody run out naked through. I mean, it's just, sure, yes, let's do that. That's a great idea. We'll put a lot of resources and energy into making that vision happen in the name of art. And I loved it.
Yeah, well, it is something. Creativity is something that is often not thought of when we're thinking about the structure of society, and yet it is a critical thing, and it does liberate people. Artists all over the world have experienced that kind of freedom to express themselves in different ways. But it also meant a life of some impecuniarity. In other words, not a lot of dough floating around. You had to work part-time to keep things going. I understand. What was that balance like, the sort of having enough material security and then having this sort of artistic and lifestyle freedom? It was a bit of a contrast, the two.
Yeah, it's a dance. But looking back, you know, I had a lot of energy and I didn't need to sleep that much. And that's kind of what you just make do.
And it was exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that counts for a lot. Then you took an interesting diversion off to Malaysia. How did that happen?
I was in Kuala Lumpur for a little over a year, doing an artist in residency, where I devoted myself wholeheartedly to tying knots, sitting on a stool in the middle of the jungle and working on a very large hammock installation, which was a giant weaving made of jute string. And that's what I loved about being an artist, is you get to engage in these activities that are just, yes, this is what I need to do with my life at this moment, even though it doesn't make any sense. So anyway, I sat there for a long time.
And, so how did you come across the idea of tying knots with jute fiber? I mean, jute's probably endemic to the area.
It is, yeah. Conceptually, I was working with the idea of a net, like this strength that's created with just one tiny knot after the other, and how large and vast you can make that, and how many people it could support. I mean, I'm not a structural engineer, but I did fit quite a lot of people hanging in this wild thing that I'd made.
How many people, Tessa? How many people did you get up to?
Oh, I don't know exactly. Probably over 20.
My goodness, that's a cohabitation of an interesting order. And I gather this was because of a boyfriend, and that sort of situation kind of took a hike, and you came back. You came back from your knot tying. By the way, is your art installation hammock still extant in Kuala Lumpur? Do you know?
Well, it was shown for some time, and then I'm sure it rotted into the jungle like everything does.
So it was actually mounted outside in the wild.
Well, it was in an old airplane hangar,
actually. Airplane hangar and a hanging device of that didn't hang anybody, fortunately. So back in Canada, somewhere around 2007, you then plunged into what was to be quite a formative experience. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, at that time, so I came back and I was a little disillusioned with the art world. I'd sort of made up my mind that I wasn't going to make a career of that as much as I loved it. What I did love, though, was working with my hands. You know, like tying knots in itself is just this repetitive action. You know, it's like, and you very visibly see the work that you're doing. And I loved that aspect of it. And you know, that time in Kuala Lumpur was quite a hungry time also, I would say. Yes. And I came back and I felt incredibly called to just do slow, steady, beautiful work outdoors with my hands. And I just wanted to farm it wherever I could. And it happened. It was one of those decisions that's just like, no, this is what I'm doing. There wasn't even, you know, when a decision doesn't even feel like a decision, suddenly you're just doing it.
It's a natural progression.
I'd heard, you know, through a friend of a friend that there was a farm school on Cortez, and I was there. There wasn't any, I just went there. So this was Cortez Island. The program's called the Linnea Ecological Farm Program. It's a year-long program. It was an incredible experience. It gave me a grounding in the sort of nuts and bolts of ecological farming, as well as instilling a very deep sort of passion around the issues that surround agriculture.
When you arrived at the farm, your first impression when you actually got there, do you remember what it was?
Oh, well, it all felt too good to be true. It was like a dream. I mean, there was 11 students a year. We all lived in this big house. It was on two lakes, so you could canoe to, you know, town. That I'm making air quotes, town, you know, the place where you could, you know, buy things. And, you know, we would spend 3 or 4 days a week in classrooms, you know, for part of the day learning things like soil science and, you know, permaculture and different things. And then we would spend some time in our test plots where we would, you know, do our own experiments. And then we would work together communally on the farm, which was also a income for the school.
So Tessa, if you were standing on this land and saying, this is too good to be true, what was it that made it seem so special, so important and sort of seminal in your life?
It's always a feeling, isn't it? A hard to describe feeling when you know you're in the right place. I knew I was in the right place, and I knew that that the skills that I was learning were important, and I felt that in the fiber of my being, you know, it just felt the right thing to do. I don't know what that is.
It's a wonderful feeling, though, when you get it.
It is.
This farm, Linnea Farm School on Cortez Island, was founded, as I understand, in 1987, 314 acres, and managed by David Buckner. He was sort of the main person. I'm led to believe that he died in 2009, but while you were there, he was the person who really shaped the coursework that you did. What kind of a person was he?
He talked so slowly. he would ask him a question, and there were so many questions, right? Because we were so excited to be learning this material. So we would just, surround him. We would, we'd ask questions about compost, and he would just take in your question, and then it was like nothing was happening for way longer than is comfortable. He would just be sort of looking off, because it really mattered to him to give you the exact true response that was really carefully well thought out. He never said anything off the cuff. It was careful and thoughtful, and he had a depth of character that was really astounding and really cared about what he was teaching.
It was interesting. I looked him up before the show, and at his obituary was very plain. It said nothing about his work on the farm. It said just that he was a really nice guy and all his family were mentioned. And it was only through an interview on the radio station in Nelson called Deconstructing Dinner, I believe, that I even could get any information about what kind of person he was. And what you're saying is that he was exceptionally focused on what he was doing and not the slightest bit interested in sort of fame or fortune. He was trying to make sure you understood what you needed to understand. Is that about right?
Absolutely. And I guess everybody changes the world in their own ways, but so many of the graduates of that program went on to be very successful farmers or food advocates. Even the founder of Young Agrarians, the executive, our Sarah Dent, she went to the Linnea Farm program as well. I mean, it created a ton of individuals across Canada and the States who are carrying on this work in different capacities.
And I now understand that the farm has been purchased or taken over by the BC Land Conservancy and made into a permanent sort of nonprofit entity. Are students still going there now in the same way they did? Because he's not there anymore, obviously.
No. So I couldn't speak exactly to the history of how it all rolled out, but I don't believe that there are students currently there. It is a land trust, though, which is a really interesting and amazing thing. And it was a land trust when I was there as well. And I was very interested in that idea, like, because it was a community of people who were stewards of this land that nobody owned, which, now in my work with the Young Agrarians is something that we explore quite often with folks in terms of alternatives to land ownership.
Right. An early version of that. The other thing about the farm was that it was based around permaculture. It was that breathed life into pretty much everything that was done there, as I understand.
Yeah, there was all sorts of systems designed into that. So there was an elementary school there. There was somebody who was doing animal husbandry. There was the market garden, which was selling vegetables to the community, and all these different aspects working together. And each individual or family sort of working towards the larger goal.
Another person who became a mentor for you around this time and a bit before, perhaps, was a wild Irishman from the hills near Argenta. Tell us about Vince McIntyre, Tessa.
Oh, he is so dear to my heart. He is another person who set me on the path of this work and who I love so dearly. When I was living in Vancouver, and I was just in the process of launching my first farm business, which was an urban farm. And I had moved into this house and I had a roommate, and she immediately said, "You have to go to Argenta and meet my dad." And so I did. And Argenta is this little hamlet in the Kootenays. And Vince was living sort of way up in the mountains on land that he didn't own. He squatted there for years and years. And then he farmed in the valleys, and he farmed potatoes, of course, and cabbage and carrots and storage crops. And he did all his farming with horses in the way of the old country. And he
Big horses?
They're mid-sized horses. Yeah, okay. Work horses anyway.
Yeah, work horses.
A team. Hmm. And he is the most alive person I'd met ever. Just, you know, the energy of spring. I mean, he was in his 60s at least when I met him. And it was just that. It was just so vibrant. And he did everything the hard way. You know, he didn't have any equipment. It was all just labor, but there was so much joy in the labor and so much grace in the labor. You know, he taught me how to farm in this way that's like a dance. You know, it's like there's a rhythm to the, you know, shoving the fork into the ground and lifting the carrots, and there's a row of people and you're all pulling them up, and then you're washing them in bins, and you know, before you know it, you've got a storehouse full of, you know, 10,000 pounds of carrots. It was that type of work.
I have a vision of a very large building and a lot of carrots and a lot of happy, smiling faces.
Yeah.
That's what Vince showed you from what you're saying, this notion that you could be happy physically working hard, but happy and have a sense of community with the people around you.
Yeah.
This sounds, again, like an extension of things that came to you from time to time, but as time went by, each of these, like David Buckner, Vincent McIntyre, and you know the way you could live when you were in Montreal, and those moments tying many knots in Kuala Lumpur. I mean, community, connection, shared workloads, taking some joy in what you're doing. These seem to be currents that I'm hearing running through your account.
Yeah, Warren, I mean, it's you're making sense of my life now. Oh, you're right. It does kind of make sense in a way, doesn't it? And, you know, now I'm on this path. I'm becoming a certified mediator to help that sort of those relationship aspects flourish. It's true. It does have a kind of, it makes sense.
You're going to hand out a lot of carrots to a lot of people. That is you're getting at the sort of internal process of farming and food production that makes it not just a workplace exercise, but sort of, you might even say, some kind of spiritual exercise in a certain way, in a deep personal exercise at any rate. So then farming became your world. Going to a 28-acre area next to the Vancouver host, one of the institutions run by Vancouver Coastal Health. Talk about that a little bit. That's right down in the heart of Vancouver. It's in the center of suburbia, you might say.
It certainly is. Yeah, so there's a care facility on 28 acres and an old care facility for folks with disabilities, long-term disabilities, and all this land. And of course it was slated for development, but there was a group of women, myself included, who were very excited to develop some programming there. So we had a vision for creating a farm with educational aspects, with ties to the institution itself, so providing programming, garden programming for the residents, as well as some healthy food, often in the form of juices. And we had this big vision, and we were just going to make it happen, and we did. So we made it a deal with the institution where we were allowed to farm a certain area for our own profit in exchange for food and programming with the residents of the care facility.
How did you find your four fellow project participants, to put them in those terms? Four other women who really felt the same way as you did in many ways.
Well, there was a woman, Jen Rashley, who was sort of heading up the project. She was the one who had the relationship with the institution, and she sort of gathered us to her. I forget in what way we all sort of came to meet, but we, yeah, that's a good question. I don't recall exactly.
You just amalgamated out of the ether. You were connected by some deep connection you didn't fully understand. Anyway, you started working, and the program has done really well. And in fact, this land is now permanently established as a food-growing piece of land.
Yeah, and that is an incredible victory, and one that I didn't see coming whatsoever. I mean, it's amazing. They built a SkyTrain station on that property and a Shoppers Drug Mart and all kinds of stuff, but they left the farm. So the farm was running at the point where they were starting to think about development at that point for about 6 years, 6 or 7 years. And there was enough community support and we had enough ties and volunteers, and there was enough people who loved it and valued what we were doing that it was maintained. And that, you know, when we started, urban farming was pretty fringe, but in that time it really took off, and there was more and more urban farms and more people talking about it, and the whole Green Vancouver initiative was happening, and you know, food production in cities was starting to get a lot of attention.
Did you find that the community around this area was supportive, that people knew about it and supported maintaining it, or was it sort of an administrative decision within Vancouver Coastal Health? Was it a community-based or administrative?
There was so much community support. I mean, and you know, I learned how much time it takes to build those relationships, because you know, there's this set of high rises that was across, and there's people like just looking out their windows for, you know, a year or 2 years before they finally come down and say, yeah, we've been watching you, and what are you doing? And, you know, I have an idea about broad beans. You know, I brought these seeds. You know, people just tell their stories. When food's involved, you know, it something comes alive in people.
And so they spoke out, obviously, strongly and supported this project and kept it going. I mean, kept it from being swallowed up by urban sprawl. There are very few farms, I'm sure you're aware, Tessa, in Vancouver. The only other one I'm aware of is the UBC farm, which went through a similar kind of process. How sort of nip and tuck was the process of establishing it as a permanent operation? Was that a tense process, or did it seem to be foreordained from the beginning that it would somehow stay as farmland?
Well, I don't take any credit for that, because to be totally honest, I had no faith that it would. I fully believed that the bulldozers would be there. And it was Jen Rashley who really was, from the very beginning, doing really important work like collecting data, which is what we needed in order to make the case for the farm.
Right.
You know, I was on the ground doing the farming, and I sort of said, come what may. And then I had already relocated back to the Okanagan at the time when the actual development was taking place.
What did you say when you heard it had gone through?
I couldn't believe it.
But you did believe it in the end.
I did.
Good. Because I think it's happened. I want to make sure you know that, Tessa. It's actually happened. So you came back to the Okanagan, and this time you leased another substantial area, 56 acres this time, with a partner. And you went into market gardening in the city, more or less, also within the city limits of Kelowna, I understand.
No, I was just outside of Armstrong.
Okay, just outside. Okay.
Yeah, so I had actually through the Young Agrarians come to the Okanagan, went to the first Young Agrarians mixer in the Okanagan, met tons of other really inspired young farmers, connected with them. And I was just asking every single person, like, you know, is there land available that I could possibly farm? And through connections that I met there, I heard about some folks. Sorry, did you have something you
wanted to? I just wanted to, how many of them were graduates from Linnea Farm School? Because you said they'd really spawned a whole generation almost of young farmers.
Well, there was no other Linnea graduates in the Okanagan.
Yes.
We were, that school attracted folks from everywhere. So I think half of the people that I graduated with were American. There was lots of Americans, some from the East Coast. There's several from my graduate class in Ontario farming. So we're spread out.
Okay. So here you are, you're having a mixer, you're meeting people, you're inspired. What comes next?
I heard about some land, some farmers, organic farmers in Armstrong who were slowing down, but who had this incredible property that they were, you know, wanting to step back from. And basically I just did some door knocking and met some lovely people, David and Shelley, and talked to them. They were very welcoming. They said, yes, please come farm. And so myself and my ex-partner moved up there. We lived in an Airstream trailer and we launched a new farm business. And this was farming on a much larger scale than I was doing in Vancouver. So we were using a lot more machinery and we were growing a lot more food. It was really our goal to make our living farming. And we were very successful in doing that. So neither of us had to work off farm. We were both full-time and doing quite well.
How was it that that was possible? Was the farm in Vancouver was connected to a lot of other things that were not remunerative, but this one was solely sort of a business operation with the farm as its business?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I have an entrepreneurial spirit and, you know, you have to be creative and you have to be good at marketing as well as the actual growing. So we were selling food to whoever would buy food. So we were running a CSA program, a community supported agriculture program. Mm. We were selling at the Kelowna Farmers Market, other farmers markets. We were selling to restaurants and wineries and, you know, just as many avenues as we could possibly find. Because we were good at producing the food and we're really lucky in a lot of ways because we had some infrastructure on the property, like several greenhouses that were there when we arrived that we were allowed to use. And that allowed us to extend our season to a certain degree, which is very important when you're trying to fill in the sort of shoulder seasons, the sort of hunger gaps in farming.
Was this something that grew as you were working on it? Did you find that your marketing or changes in social patterns were bringing more customers to your farm over time?
Yeah, things grow. I mean, they just do. When you put energy into them, they grow. So, you know, it takes time, kind of like, you know, it takes time for people to come out and see what you're doing in the urban farm setting. It's the same sort of thing. Customers get to know you. You become a familiar face and a trusted face. People start to see that you have a product of really high value. And that takes time to build in a community. It doesn't happen overnight.
It's interesting because on a previous program, Andrea Gunner, who's an agrologist and very experienced in the sort of overall picture of farming and producing food, was around when the exact opposite process took place. All of the small and medium-sized farming operations in the whole southern half of the province basically collapsed when it came to vegetables in particular, and the market was taken over by very large-size distributors, basically, of food. They didn't grow the food. They were distributing food that was purchased from far away and in very large quantities from places where labor was cheap and the local people did not consume the food. They simply shipped it out to be sold elsewhere. So you're actually working in the opposite direction. Did you find that you had to explain things to people, or did they fairly quickly understand what you were all about?
There certainly is an amount of education that needs to happen. But, you know, when you're selling to the farmers market crowd, typically those folks are already fairly dedicated to the cause because they're doing several things. One, they're taking time out of their day to go to a special place, you know, that, where they can buy only a certain product. It's already, you know, it's not as convenient as the grocery store. The prices are higher. So they're already at that level of dedication. And of course, you know, there's new products like, oh, look, bulb fennel. What do you do with bulb fennel? And then people get excited about that. I mean, I always was of the mind that I wanted to grow as many different varieties as possible. Diversity was super important for me, not only because it's important from an ecological perspective, but also because it keeps farming from being boring. And so I was like, yeah, let's grow popcorn, you know? We might not make any money growing popcorn, but I mean, let's try. Or these strange eggplant or, you know, different things like that. And so there's a certain amount of education if you're growing new products.
Indeed, indeed. I didn't realize you could grow popcorn straight out of the ground. I thought you had to put it on your stove. But I've learned something today. Popping, we'll call it popping corn. So that was a commercial success. You described it when we were talking before the show. You described it as classic lettuce to rich people operation. Why? That's not necessarily a denigration. It's just a description, shall we say, of who was buying and what they were interested in. They were interested in fresh, fairly fragile products that they could get from you in a far more appetizing state than they could necessarily get from, say, a large retail grocery operation.
Yeah, and part of that has to do with the economics of farming in general. And for us to make a go of it, given how much labor it takes to be an organic farmer, you have to have a certain price point. And so at that, you have to sell direct to consumer because you absolutely cannot compete with the farms that have 1,000 acres of baby lettuce and who are mechanized to a certain degree. Right. So, yeah.
How about the joy and the vitality and the excitement that you felt with Vince McIntyre and on the Linnea farm? Was there any way to bring some of that kind of atmosphere into the work you were doing? I mean, you obviously had people hired to work with you. Mm-hmm. I've talked to Herman Louise Bruins about that, and they've talked about the ergonomics of harvesting. And obviously part of the ergonomics is if you get a routine, you get a sort of smooth motion, things go easily, and you can kind of do like you were doing in Kuala Lumpur, you know, tying one knot after another, you get kind of a rhythm. Was that possible to bring that into what you were doing on the farm?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, we did hire some employees. Well, actually, I mean, just under special circumstances. So, I mean, a lot of what I was learning there was that it can be a grind for two people to do it.
Yes.
And more people is more joyful. And so, you know, I was always looking to recreate that experience that I had in the Kootenays with Vince, you know, where people would show up and volunteer and they would do it just in exchange for, you know, bread and butter and you know, maybe some storage carrots at the end. Mm. But it was more challenging to find here.
If you had your druthers and you could have a farm where that kind of spirit pervaded the operation, would it draw you in?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, there's the young agrarians may be starting up something that will be like that one day, hopefully. The next phase was heading off to Pilgrim's Produce, near Armstrong again. Talk about that. That was a different phase of your experience in the agricultural field.
Yeah, so same area. I was in Armstrong and I had wrapped up the business at Deerfoot Farm and was looking for other opportunities to continue farming and continue learning. And I met Robin and Catherine Hetler, who became great friends and also mentors of mine. And they were sort of looking for opportunities to step back. So myself and a few other folks sort of took over management of the farm for that season. And I watched as Rob sort of gracefully allowed us to make a bunch of mistakes and, you know, just have that with our energy.
Smiled benignly.
Yeah, guided us when we needed guidance and allowed us to use the incredible business that they have built up over the years. They have, you know, 14 acres under production with annual vegetables and fruits and nuts and all kinds of things happening there. And so that was another great year of learning more about what a business can look like scaled up, and a business that had been running for, well, it just experienced their 30th anniversary.
My goodness. So what made it extraordinary that captured your imagination when you saw what they were doing? What was it about that?
Well, I think Rob really cares about people, and that value shines through. It's more about the people than anything else. So, you know, it was those relationships, I think. I mean, besides the fact that he's a great farmer, he's developed really incredible relationships with the people who are around.
I couldn't help think when you paused before you answered that the spirit of David Buckner still lived and you were channeling him at that moment. The didn't want to answer until you'd formulated your thoughts. But maybe that's something that also becomes part of a person when you're close to the land. The land it doesn't talk in the same, you know, chattery way. It's you have to listen to it to some extent maybe as well. You can answer that. That could be considered a question.
there's so much to be learned from just observing. I often would say that being a farmer is just being a constant witness to these miracles, you know, things sprouting and things growing. And by mid-season, when everything's just rolling, it's just everywhere you turn, there's something happening. And yes, you've been a part of it, but it's also just,
you're observing the miracle. Yeah. You're not making it happen. Well, Tessa, we've almost made it up to the present through that interesting journey that you took, picking up values and finding mentors, really showing how working in growing food is more than just necessarily a mechanical exercise. It's also a much deeper thing. And as you said just a moment ago, looking at the miraculous things that happen when seeds are put in the ground and the ground is fertile, they do the work, and the work is inscrutable. It just happens. And we sit there wondering. I've often told people who are impressed by the achievements of technological science that if that is appealing to them, then I'd suggest they go back to their laboratory and make a dandelion. And when they've got a dandelion, they come and visit me again, and I will sit at their feet, and they can be a mentor for me. So far, it hasn't happened. Now, in 2018, you were involved with the Young Agrarians from the beginning, 2013. But in 2018, your relationship changed because the organization received some grant money that allowed them to hire land matching coordinators. Why don't you just give us a little picture of sort of Young Agrarians and the process that went from 2013 to 2018? Because obviously there was an evolutionary process going on there.
Certainly. So, I mean, just a little background. The Young Agrarians is the largest sort of educational resource network for new and young ecological farmers in Canada. So we offer sort of farmer-to-farmer programming, and our whole mandate is to grow the next generation of food growers. So we do that in a number of ways, through education, training, land access, business mentorship, different resources. It's really about creating a community of people Canada-wide, but most of our programming is offered in Western Canada.
And BC is a center, is it not, for that activity? I mean, on this side of the continent.
Yes. In BC, we were hearing from people that land access is one of the number one challenges for new and young farmers. So, you know, we all know the land is expensive. We don't need to get into that. And there are a myriad of issues around the barriers for new farmers. But two-thirds of all of the new farmers who are entering agriculture do not come from family farm backgrounds. Like me, they didn't inherit farmland, nor did they grow up farming. So there's different issues there. One is that there's no land, and there's a knowledge gap as well. So Young & Gerns is really trying to meet those needs.
I've talked to a couple of farming families about the fact that their children are not particularly motivated to become farmers. And what I've noticed is that for some of them, there have been periods of time, if you go back 30 years, for example, when the difficulty of maintaining a farm was so considerable that I think children saw their parents struggling and, in fact, sometimes going through huge upheavals because of banks taking away some of their land because they couldn't afford to keep up mortgage payments because of high interest rates, that kind of stuff. That's applied to a number of families that have been on this program, that it means that the children don't see their family, their parents going through a good time. They see their parents going through a really, really challenging time. And to some degree, there's an instinct to not have to go through that kind of challenging time. And the generation that's coming in to farming is coming in with a different feeling about it, as there is a move towards locally based, organic, healthy food again. I mean, it's a return to the way things were before World War II, when there were no agrochemicals as we know them today, and the supply lines that are everywhere were not available. Maybe you could just talk about how you see young agrarians playing a role in that transition away from sort of commercial, large-scale commercial growing to more local, more embedded farming.
Well, there's a mentality that bigger is better, and it's deeply culturally embedded. And I like to say that small is beautiful, and small is quite strong also. So what, I mean, I'm speaking personally for myself, but I believe Young Agrarians as well as an organization really strongly values this, is that, you know, creating more smaller, diverse farms will create a stronger net. It's like that hammock, you know. Mm-hmm. And what do those people need in order to be supported? And one of the number one things that comes up is they need access to land. And how are they going to access land when they can't afford the $80,000 an acre kind of price tag that it has? And so we need to get really creative and, you know, maintain a sort of, well, I mean, positive attitude about the possibility. You know, what are the ways that we can make this happen if this is the future that we really want to see?
Indeed.
So
how is that process working out as you see, obviously not just in the last 2 years since you've been working for Young Agrarians, 2.5 years, but through your involvement with the organization and what you've been doing over the last 20 years, do you see trends coming up that are indicating where we're going and whether it's to stay with this massive high volume food production with tremendously long supply lines and taking advantage of inexpensive workforces in faraway places? Do you see a trend that you can measure, or you can say, I am seeing this?
Well, I can speak to, you know, the amount of inquiries that I get through my position. So this is, you know, we have fielded a ton of inquiries from both landowners and from new farmers in all stages of that dream. So, you know, I refer to the very sort of initial stage of those folks as being farm curious. Hmm. And in April of last year, after COVID, I received 7 times the amount of regular inquiries from folks that I would deem farm curious. So these are folks who are living in cities and who are saying, you know, I've just been woken up to the reality of the insecurity of my situation or the global situation. And I think that, you know, this is something that I would like to get involved in. And they don't have a background farming.
Do you feel that they are when you call them farm curious, did you feel that they are just in a sort of temporary panic state, or do you sense that the inquiries indicate that they're really serious at some point? They may not be right there yet, but they are asking questions that indicate more than just a momentary flash in the pan.
Well, I mean, that's not something that I can judge. And so my role is to be incredibly encouraging no matter what. Like, yeah, you're a data analyst and you want to change your career path. Well, here are some, you're not ready for the land matching program. You're not maybe ready to lease farmland and launch a farm business. But here are some apprenticeships and here are some books you should read and here are some people you should go talk to. And maybe in 5 years, those folks will be producing food. But, you know, that's our role.
When you said seven times as many, just so people understand, in absolute numbers, what would that roughly mean? Say, in a week, how many calls might you get now versus how many you used to get a couple of years ago?
Well, that's my weak spot, is that remembering the numbers. I'd have to pull up a spreadsheet for that.
So I won't ask you how many knots you tied in Kuala Lumpur.
Thousands. I mean, over in a year, we have thousands of inquiries a year.
Really? You in the shoe swap, or young agrarians overall?
Yeah. So I live in Vernon, and my region is sort of 2.5 hours anywhere around that. So right. I'm in the South Okanagan, North Okanagan, Central Okanagan, shoe swap towards Kamloops.
Right, and you would get thousands of inquiries. That's interesting, because that isn't something that gets into the news all the time. It does indicate quite a significant change of heart, that people are looking into a new way of kind of not just relating to food, but also relating to how they live their lives, whether they become farmers or not. But they're looking to make a shift in their lives. The word these days is pivot. They're thinking of pivoting. And that's the sense you're getting from the calls you're getting.
Yeah, so I just pulled up some data for you. 3,700 farmers and landholders were engaged in the last 2.5 years. There you go.
Okay, that's the total. And most of those would be, if it's seven times more since COVID began, most of those would have been in the last calendar year, or the last 12 months or so.
Yeah. There's certainly been some energy, you know, that people are starting to find out about the program and learn about the services that we offer. It spreads a lot by word of mouth. So that it's definitely growing in interest, and it's been overwhelmingly successful. Mm-hmm. We had no idea that there would be so much interest.
So when you say successful, do you mean matching people with land, that you've been able to successfully link young, enthusiastic, new farmers with old farmers' land?
Yeah, and not only old farmers. Any land that is not being used for agriculture. I mean, people come to us, give us a call and say, you know, I've got 3 acres that I've never used, or I've got a 1,500-acre ranch that I can't ranch anymore. Anybody's really welcome to get in touch, and we work with them to assess the agricultural potential for that land and what would be more suitable in terms of production type. But, you know, since the land matching program started, now I've got the stats in front of me. We've completed 135 land matches on nearly 6,000 acres.
Wow. So that's quite impressive. And how many of those would be, how many of those acres would be, just roughly percentage, previously farmed, and how many of them would be land that had not been farmed but was sort of available if there was the right person coming along to use it? Is the majority previous farmland?
No, the majority is land that hadn't been utilized.
Interesting.
For farming.
So it just been lying fallow, but not even lying fallow in a formal sense, just simply space that was on people's property that was not being used. Mm-hmm. That must be very interesting for the landowners to suddenly see sprouts sprouting up all over the land that they had previously just walked past and not engaged with particularly. We're drawing to a close, Tessa, and I want to kind of I want to kind of see the overall picture that you've described, and on our next session, talk about what's happening now and how the mechanics of land matching works, whether you get out and land a lot, which I'm sure you would be very happy to do from everything you've told our listeners today. And I think it's time that we also integrated this, what you're doing, into the bigger picture, because it is part of a bigger picture, and I think it's a transition process that we're in right now. So I want to thank you very much, Tessa Wetherill, the land match. I called you coordinator. Is that what your official title is, or is it manager?
Land matcher, I would
land
say.
Land matcher. All right.
Yeah.
Matchmaker, bring me some land. Tessa, thank you very much. It's been wonderful talking with you, and I look forward to talking with you next week. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.